episode is all about our next concert series called The Class of 85. In this episode, we talk about and we explore the incredible little coincidence that happened in history where three of the titans of the Baroque period, who went by the name of Johann Sebastian Bach, George Frederick Handel, and Domenico Scarlatti were all miraculously born in the same year. This is our Class of 85, 1685 to be honest. My guests for this episode, I am very pleased to welcome two of my dearest friends and esteemed colleagues, Michaela Oberg, who is Principal Flute. Welcome, Michaela.
Thank you, Maddie. Nice to be here.
And Susanna Lavergren, one of our esteemed sopranos, who I've been working with from the very beginning.
Thanks so much, Maddie. I'm so happy to be here.
Susanna, I first met you in a pub in Barradine.
That's
in far
right.
Northwestern New South Wales.
This is how all the good Maddie stories begin.
I'm so glad I met you in that random town in far western New South Wales. How do we manage to be in the same town at the same time?
In such a tiny little town.
Crazy.
As well.
Crazy. Another coincidence. Or rather, perhaps it was work.
Well, it was. But it's been amazing to get to know you and to begin working with you and to discover your love of Bach and your talent for singing it. And if it hadn't been for you and your incredible voice and your love of this music, I don't think Bach Academy would be what it is today.
That's such a beautiful thing to say. Thank you. It makes me think about maybe a year before that moment when we met, I'd just done a summer school in the Tafel Music Baroque summer school, and I sang a lot of Bach there, and I just discovered, I realized that I really just needed to sing a lot of Bach, and I thought, how am I going to do this in Sydney? Because I don't think I had kids just yet, but I really needed to find more Bach opportunities, and it was a match made in heaven.
Isn't it incredible how the things you need will come into your life when you need them?
Mm.
Yeah, I've been telling myself that for years, but occasionally I do
just keep waiting.
True. Yes.
Yeah.
And Michaela, my dear, how long have I known you?
Let's not talk about that.
It's been wonderful to see you grow into the role of principal flute, and you the way you carry the wind section and your incredible expressivity and technical brilliance is really quite incredible and staggering to hear and watch.
Thank you, Maddie. That's very kind. I'm not sure. Completely accurate, but
I'll take it. Going to think to duetting with you, Mick.
We are. We do a lot of duets together with Bach Academy and Bach, don't we?
Something about the flute and the high soprano voice, isn't there?
Yeah. We work well together.
We do.
We'll talk more about that later. But in our concert series, Talking Bach, we feature one of Bach's orchestral suites. Now, Michaela, you've just performed the B minor suite with Bach Academy, haven't you?
I sure have. I think I'm still recovering. That's a big work.
Certainly is a big work. And it's so brilliantly written for the flute, as are the other orchestral suites brilliantly written for the other instruments. And in this concert series, we will be performing the early version of Bach's orchestral suite number 3 in D major. Now, you'll be wondering where the trumpets and timpanis are, but in fact, he didn't add them until much later, maybe even into the 1740s. Mm. And the version we are playing is just with strings in its very first version. But here is a little bit of this wonderful orchestral suite for our listeners to hear just now. Susanna, you've had a lot to do with ensemble singing your whole professional life. What attracted you to this particular cantata of Bach we are performing?
It's quite different from everything else we've done, isn't it? First of all, I think there are two things that make it particularly different from the works that we know and that we perform together a lot. One is the language, which is in Italian, and the other is the subject matter, which is, I'm very used to singing to Jesus or to God or to my soul or something very, very spiritual. But in this cantata, it's, they don't think they actually know who it's actually written for, but whoever it is was very dear to the writer or composer's heart. And it's this very human story of a friend, a very, very highly esteemed friend, going away and how the loss of that friend. And I feel like I've had that happen to me many times with family overseas. And you guys have departed these shores to have some brilliant career overseas. And that's kind of the subject matter here. A lot of the words are about all the amazing things that my friend will accomplish. So it's a similar mixture of joy and sadness, but it's quite focused on the singer and the composer and how we feel about that. And it makes a big difference to actually act it out, to not be singing to a spiritual presence. I suppose back in Bach's day, when you're singing to Jesus, it was extremely personal, right? But in a way, that's the difference. It's more on the earthly plane. The Italian, which is just a riot seeing Bach in Italian. I think there's one other cantata. Have you heard the other cantata?
Isn't it called In Amorata or In Amoroso or
is
something
it?
Like I'm, that?
And I it's really should for listen to it.
Bass baritone.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Apparently, it's not the best Italian, not the best Italian word setting either, but it just changes the flavor of the music. Mick, do you find that the flavor of the music changes?
Oh, completely different. This one, it is chalk and cheese to the other, like even obbligato arias that we have. Absolutely.
I was actually going to ask you about ornamentation. Because when I sing Bach, usually I wouldn't do much ornamentation, especially in the da capo. But here I really feel like I need to, and it's more of an Italian thing. Would you agree?
More Italian it, yeah.
Do you do more ornamentation here, or do you actually just not naturally do more?
Especially in the slow movement, I feel like I've got more room for that sort of extempore ornamentation. Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
And throwing it over to you, Mick, how is this cantata to play for you, sort of technically and emotionally?
Emotionally it's quite enjoyable, but like I said, it's just so different in its structure and in its sort of language, its melodic language almost, and sort of how we work together than his other sort of arias or obbligato arias in the cantatas. It's almost like a flute concerto in its structure. We've got, fast movement, slow movement, fast movement in threes, that sort of dance-like finish to it as well. So technically it's fairly virtuosic, but Bach, he does always such a good job of writing the flute music right to the limit of your sort of your comfortable zone. And sometimes he goes just beyond it and then he brings it back again. I feel like this one is just at the top of the comfort level. So it's a good key, it's a good range. It's written really well to sort of, move with the soprano part. So although it's sort of technically difficult, it's still a joy to play.
This cantata, I feel, really does link back to the other two of the class of 85 because let's think about Handel. He wrote so much in Italian, didn't he? All of his operas were in Italian. And then we have Domenico Scarlatti, who is Italian. And here we have a cantata by Bach in Italian as well. But I think that's probably the only link between the other class of 85.
Yeah.
Alumni.
They managed to keep quite separate, didn't they?
Yes, well,
except for Scarlatti and Handel, I believe. But Bach didn't really come across the other, especially Scarlatti?
No, he would never have met Scarlatti. In fact, I'm pretty sure he never did.
Yeah, but they're all keyboardists, like such virtuosic keyboardists.
That's the link. That is one of the big link of our class of 85. They were all extraordinary keyboard players. Both Handel and Bach were virtuoso organists. Scarlatti wasn't. He was a harpsichordist, hence his 555 keyboard sonatas. But yes, and I believe that that gave these three composers a real grounding and knowledge of harmony, you know, because if you play a treble instrument like the violin or the flute, you know, unless you're very lucky, you don't get to study harmony and the way music is built from the ground up, from the, you know, the bass line up. But all three of our composers were really informed in that department, which I think could only have made them great composers.
No, I think that's huge. It probably really helped their experimentation and their boundary pushing, which was, this happened so fast over their lifetimes. They all had quite long lives as well.
Yeah.
Say Mozart or a Schubert. They got to do a lot.
Well, it was an amazing time in Europe. If we think about what was going on in Europe at the time, we were about in Germany to embark upon those big Prussian wars with King Frederick the Great, who was one of the most awful warmongers, but fabulous musicians, ironically, of the time. And Italy, gosh knows.
Fabulous flute player.
Yeah. So whether it was coming or going, it wasn't Italy really, was it?
And Scarlatti. No, there's no Italy, no Germany.
No, they weren't.
No.
Scarlatti was travelling between Portugal and Spain a lot of the time. He settled in Madrid for the whole of the rest of his later years. And that
he was born in Spain, but born in Naples, which was part of Spain. That blew my mind.
Okay, that I did not know. Love this.
I was Wikipedian last night.
Oh, God. That's fantastic.
Interesting, isn't it? How different Europe was in that time.
But I find it fascinating that these three composers had such different lives and how on earth they were born in the very same year and had such an incredible effect on everybody afterwards. If we just talk about Scarlatti for a second, he's not known for his choral works like his father Alessandro was, but those keyboard sonatas changed everything. Mm. You know, they influenced Czerny, who was then Beethoven's teacher, and then Beethoven took that keyboard concerto style forwards into the future, and look what he did with it. If it weren't for Scarlatti, none of that would have happened.
How did the Bach keyboard, did it somehow come together? I know they didn't work together, but as the generations went on, have they looked into how stylistically the two styles influenced each other?
Well, I'm sure Bach was influenced by Italian music, very much so, particularly Vivaldi, as we know.
Especially in this cantata.
But given the fact that they were the very same age, I'm not sure whether Bach would have ever heard any Domenico Scarlatti. I'm happy to be proved wrong.
No, I was wondering if in future generations after those two, you know, when talking about Czerny and Beethoven, how their influence of Bach and Scarlatti would have influenced both, say, Czerny and Beethoven and generations beyond. It'd be interesting to think about how the styles intertwined.
I think there's a PhD in there for you, Suzanne.
No, thanks.
I know, absolutely. But yeah, what a standout year in history, don't you think?
Amazing.
Now, I have included in this program a little bit of Jean-Philippe Rameau. Because he was born only 2 years earlier in 1683. And I thought it would be fantastic to put in a piece of Rameau just as a sort of litmus test, if you like, or a little example of what was happening in France. Because these people were literally born at practically the same time.
Amazing, isn't it? It's amazing how different. It's amazing the differences between their music for the same generation.
Yeah. I know. And Rameau is a very special case, isn't he? Because he didn't compose any of what he became very famous for, which were his operas, until he was over 50 years old.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. So let's see if we can do the math. That was, yes.
Another long life.
85 to 35, 1735. And my gosh, that was coming to the end of the Baroque period, wasn't it?
Which was really when the flute started to do all of this extremely virtuosic stuff. We talk about the Baroque period, you know, 1600 to 1750. But really, the flute, as we know it in these programs, really only came about in the beginning of the 18th century after 1700. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of the end of these composers' lives or the end of this period is when we get this music. And we didn't really have much to do before then.
That's interesting. You've given me something to think about there, Mick. I'm going to go and have a look at the dates of a lot of these compositions a little bit more carefully, because I do associate the flute with Baroque very, very, very much. But is it
high Baroque?
High Baroque. Late, yeah.
That earlier stuff, you guys were just warming up, getting everything set up until we can come into the scene properly.
Come back to absolute luck as well. They were on the same year, and I know we're talking about Rameau with the you know, doing operas later in life, but being able to live that long back in those days, they were able to just develop their craft for decades.
Yeah. Develop their style.
Mozart, just like, do it extremely quickly and die.
Yes, but Rameau, his music has such amazing colour and timbre and affect, doesn't it?
Yeah, the instrumentation, his scoring is so ahead of its time, absolutely. He uses instruments for colours, rather than harmony. It's amazing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Not to say the harmony isn't exquisite.
Also, absolutely, but just this orchestration. Yeah,
because he did have the same instruments available to him as Bach and Handel and everybody else. This Les Boreades, the Entrée de Polymnie that we are performing, is one of the most beautiful pieces of music I've ever heard. Now, Mick, this will make you laugh, because I discovered that music at an Australian youth orchestra summer academy camp, and it was organised by Youth Music Australia. And I didn't realise that it was going to be early music because I didn't read the fine print. I thought it was going to be this fantastic summer academy that had been in the past, where you go and some fabulous famous string quartet comes and coaches you on fabulous chamber music. So I all rocked up there ready for that in Adelaide. And then I walked into a room and there was Lucinda Moon, Jane Gower, Eric Hoeplich, Marion Middenway, and Paul Dyer, of course, and a raft of other seriously fantastic. Oh, Lisa Beznosik was there on flute.
Amazing.
Yes, and we were all sort of shuffled into a room, and then Lucinda said, okay, take off your chin rest and shoulder rest. And I thought, what? And then she said, didn't you know this was an early music course? And I said, no. Anyway, talk about life's coincidences, because that changed my life.
Yeah, did that have a huge influence on your future?
Well, here I am. That's amazing. Aren't I? The founder and artistic director of a Baroque orchestra. Wow.
So this Rameau piece is just from your founding story.
It is. And during that...
That's very special.
We played the whole suite from Les Boreades, and I fell in love with French Baroque music right from the word go. I was 18 when this happened, so, it was... I suppose early on, if you consider when people do come across historically informed performance practice. And we did some Telemann and a Bach orchestral suite. By the end of it, I was...
You weren't going back.
I wasn't going back. I've never given up my modern violin playing. As
She threw away her chin rest and shoulder rest.
Yes,
in all of them.
Yes, that's right.
Freedom.
Anyway, that piece of Rameau has always stayed with me, and I've been looking for a chance to program it for a long time, and I thought, the class of 85, this is it, we're going to put it in. It's a perfect opportunity to relate these composers to Rameau, who composed lots of keyboard music and a few sonatas and things, and his two famous treatises, one on keyboard technique and one on harmony, one of which caused a riot in Paris, the Querelle de Buffon, which is, for anybody out there who's interested in this, it's a fascinating little piece of history. Rameau and Voltaire had quite a robust dialogue during that time, disagreeing with each other the whole time. So there's a lot to be read about that. But I love the fact that somebody writing a treatise about harmony could cause a riot. I mean, bring on that, you know, bring those days back.
Yeah.
It'd really take something to do that these days, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I feel like we've kind of done everything.
What's an equivalent of that? But we haven't talked a lot about Handel in this podcast. Now, for me, he is incredibly interesting because unlike Scarlatti and Bach, he didn't come from a musical family. And when we think about Bach and Scarlatti, one of the first things that comes to my mind is the incredible musical dynasties they were born into.
Mm.
So Bach was the sixth generation of jobbing and working musicians in that area of Germany. And Scarlatti had Alessandro as his father and several generations before that. And I think he was the seventh of 10 children, seventh of 11 children that Alessandro and his wife had, most of which were musical and had beautiful, amazing careers in music. So Scarlatti was born into this rich, vibrant tradition, and his father was the celebrated vocal and opera composer, Scarlatti. And then Domenico comes along and revolutionizes keyboard music. And we, you know, I don't think I need to speak much about the incredible Bach family and all of the history and tradition and knowledge that came behind him.
Mm. Poor Handel just had to work it out himself.
He probably did a bit. I mean, it's interesting the concept. This also brings into the conversation the concept of nature versus nurture.
Mm.
And a couple of years ago, we did a program with Bach Academy called In Bach's Orbit. Do you remember that?
I remember that, yes. Yeah.
That was a wonderful program because I got to explore.
We did. We did Monteverdi, no.
Not in that program.
Okay.
No. But I got to explore the people that Bach had around him, like Pachelbel and Johann Christoph Bach, his older first cousin once removed, and Buxtehude and who else? Telemann and Vivaldi, all these people who really influenced and supported and nurtured Bach throughout his lifetime. And Alessandro did the same for his son, Domenico, and Pietro, the other famous brother. But Handel didn't have any of that.
Hmm.
And it's just so interesting. There he was, born in Halle to a father who was a butcher, I believe, and a mother who was a notary. And his father actively discouraged him from anything musical. However, his mother spotted the talent pretty early on, and she nurtured him quietly and would encourage him to practice in secret.
Wow.
Whenever he could.
Yeah.
But you know what? We know this better than a lot of people. Once a musician, always a musician. Mm-hmm. And if that is what you're meant to do with your life, you will find a way. I mean, I'm just thinking of people like Hector Berlioz, who was born in that village in France, La Côte Saint-André, to a lawyer father who was desperate for his son to become a doctor. And Hector dutifully went off to Paris and started his medical degree. But as soon as it came to cutting up bodies and things, he just came out the room.
It's like Telemann as well.
Telemann.
Telemann's family wanted him to become a lawyer, so he went off and became a lawyer. Look at this.
Yeah, you do hear about this happening sometimes, don't you? People encouraged in that kind of more practical sphere, and then they go off and be musicians.
Our oboist, Adam.
Of course.
Absolutely, you're right.
The first, and then he thought, nope, oboe it is.
I'm so, so, so thankful to him. The way that man plays the oboe, it's like heaven coming out of his instrument. He sings through that oboe. It's magic. Just
call him up and get him on the line.
Yes. But Handel really did do it himself, and it's interesting that he embraced Italy and England and the sensibilities and the music of those two countries.
They embraced him,
and
they?
Exactly. Yeah. They embraced him much more than his native Germany did.
Well, I've always been, you know, this nature-nurture idea. I've thought about it my whole life in a lot of different contexts, and I pretty much always err on the side of nurture. I think if you have some talent, some intelligence, some musical ability, all sorts of, you know, inward drive, you still need to have something in your environment. And I'm sure that Handel had something, for instance, his mother, to give him that start. So it's been influenced a lot by reading this book. It's actually, I'd recommend it, called, it's by Malcolm Gladwell. called Outliers, and he talks about the whole genius idea. And he says there basically aren't any geniuses that haven't had any help, that haven't had a lot of help. So I'm pretty sure we'd find something, and this is not a PhD article for me again, but I'm sure there's something. Like, I think he was around, you know, the courts. He wasn't incredibly, he had his father had a job, right? It wasn't like he was had no resources.
No, he wasn't poor, was he?
Yeah. So if you have the drive, but you also have a little bit of opportunity, then
That just makes me think, how many poor kids out there are we missing out on? How many geniuses are we missing out on because they never had the chance or the opportunities? Which is why,
Well, this is the reason why I've been thinking about it is as a feminist, you know, there's not that many female composers over the centuries, and we do try and bring them back. Also preparing Barbara Strozzi, who was actually just before these guys. But, you know, there aren't many Barbara Strozzis that have remained, you know, famous. And so I think it's interesting to think about the resources that, that people have.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. And just to play you a bit of the beautiful Handel Concerto Grosso you will be hearing, here is a little bit of our Concerto Grosso, Opus 6, number 7 in B-flat major that we are performing in this concert series. You guys for joining me on this episode of Talking Bach, exploring the incredible coincidence that was the year 1685 and these three amazing, beautiful, selfless composers who gave us all this amazing music, which has still, it is still influencing and guiding us and teaching us 300 and odd years later. Don't ask me how many because I cannot do maths. So if you'd like to come and hear the Class of 85, you can on Friday the 30th of May, 7:30 p.m. at St. James Church, King Street, Sydney, in that stunning acoustic. Or if you happen to be on the North Shore in Chatswood, you can hear us on Saturday the 31st of May at 2:30 p.m. at Our Lady of Dolores Church, which is at 94 Archer Street. If you happen to be in the Southern Highlands or fancy having a Sunday trip down there, we will be performing this beautiful program on Sunday the 1st of June, 2:30 p.m. at Bowral Memorial Hall. Tickets are available through our website at www.barkacademyaustralia.com.au. Jump on social media as well because all our links are up there. So we really hope to see you there. And you can hear Susanna Lavergren sing the fantastic Bach cantata, BWV 209, Non sa che sia dolore. And you can hear Michaela Oberg playing the wonderful obbligato flute part in that as well. And you can also hear Hannah Fraser, our gorgeous mezzo-soprano, singing the Salve Regina of Domenico Scarlatti. Thank you so much for joining us for Talking Bach. See you next time.